think it's obnoxious in this case when they go beyond their commerce powers.
Alaska joins the lawsuit against the new national health care legislation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 20th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, public health advocates call for stricter regulations on the chemical industry.
It's time to stop using children and other vulnerable populations as canaries in the coal mine.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give. And by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu.
Governor Parnell today announced that Alaska is joining 19 other states in challenging the constitutionality of the new federal health care legislation. He singled out the part of the plan that requires people to purchase health care insurance, saying it expands federal government into the lives of Alaskans.
Health insurance at the price of freedom? No.
Joined by Attorney General Dan Sullivan, Parnell said the goal of the lawsuit, originally filed by the state of Florida, is to determine the limits to the power that Congress has over states. He says it's unreasonable to impose a tax penalty on people who can't or won't buy insurance.
I think Congress has used tax penalties like that, but I think it's obnoxious in this case when they go beyond their commerce powers and impose the tax penalty. I mean, that is the element of coercion that we are standing up against at this point.
The state legislature's most consistent advocate of health care has been Anchorage Democrat Hollis French, who points to a 1993 health care proposal from Republicans featuring the same requirement that individuals purchase insurance. French sees other similarities that the governor is overlooking.
There are already good analogies out there. Social Security is a good analogy. Medicare, Medicaid, national programs that people pay into to deliver benefits.
The decision to join the lawsuit has gotten the attention of the state's congressional delegation. Democratic Senator Mark Begich criticized the governor, saying the case will require resources that could be better directed toward improving the state's economy and protecting public safety. Senator Lisa Murkowski said she is encouraged the state is joining the suit. She adds that she is looking for ways to repeal other parts of the federal law. And Congressman Don Young also praised the governor's decision, saying the Health Care Act is an infringement on the liberties of the American people. The Alaska legislature has set aside funds to pay for a review of the impacts of mining in the Bristol Bay region. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The $750,000 to pay for an independent third-party review of mining in the Bristol Bay region must still survive a potential veto by Alaska Governor Sean Parnell. But if it does, the goal is to get the process started fairly quickly. Among the lawmakers who worked diligently to get the funding approved was District 37 State Representative Bryce Edgman from Dillingham. He confirmed that the money will be funneled through a legislative committee called the Legislative Council. Edgman says it was not an easy task to get the money through the legislative process.
A lot of people really chipped in to help make this thing a reality because there's a lot of legislators that were dead set against it. And in fact, going back to the last couple of days of session, in fact, on the last day of session, there were two attempts to derail the funding, and myself and Representative Osterman were working as many legislators as possible, and we managed to fend it off and keep it in the budget and not dilute the language or to have it rewritten so that it didn't apply specifically to the Pebble Mine project, quote-unquote.
The $750,000 has been specifically set aside to conduct an independent third-party scientific and multidisciplinary study of the potential of a large mine development in the Bristol Bay drainage. At the heart of the issue is the proposed Pebble Mine that would be located near Iliamna Lake. The company looking at developing the mine says the earliest that they would apply for permits would be 2011. Representative Edgman says it would be best if the review preceded the permit applications.
For a lot of people, it would be good to have the study completed, the 18 months or the 2 years that the study would take, and then have the permitting process follow afterwards. And so there's some definite unknowns in all that, and there's also likelihood, like I said a moment ago, that the two of them, both the permitting process and this major sort of socioeconomic environmental review of the whole proposal, both of those could be going on concurrently.
The idea of having an independent third-party review of mining in the Bristol Bay drainage was supported by all of the state senators and representatives that represent the Bristol Bay region. That support also extended to the east side of Cook Inlet into the district represented by Senator Tom Wagner from Kenai, who is a member of the minority in the state Senate.
If we do this pebble mine, we want to do it right. I think maybe there's a little more funding there than needed to be put in place, but just because the funding's there doesn't mean you had to spend it all. And but I think that really has to be done. I'm very supportive of the pebble mine. I'm also a commercial fisherman. I still fish halibut. The last thing I want to see is anything interfere with a renewable resource such as the Bristol Bay Red Salmon Run.
Both supporters and opponents of the Pebble Mine are now anxiously awaiting whether or not Governor Parnell will veto the $750,000 that has been set aside to pay for the third-party review of mining in the Bristol Bay drainage. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Public health advocates in Alaska are pleased that reforms to regulations for the chemical industry have been introduced in Congress. The Safe Chemicals Act of 2010 is an attempt to revise parts of the Toxic Substances Act that was passed in 1976. Alaska Community Action on Toxics Director Pam Miller says the 34-year-old law has not had reforms such as the Clean Water and Clean Air Act have.
This law is being revised to reflect changing science and to reflect public concern and real health concerns about the effect of toxic chemicals that we're exposed to through everyday products and in our air, water, and food.
Miller says the U.S. is behind many European and Asian countries in chemical policy regulation. She's hopeful Alaska senators will support the legislation, and she says it's time the federal government updates the more than 30-year-old law.
The Toxic Substances Control Act grandfathered in more than 60,000 industrial chemicals with no safety testing. And in the 34 years since this act went into place, the EPA has required testing for only 200 chemicals out of the more than 80,000 available now for use in the U.S. and has regulated only five of those chemicals, which include known carcinogens, chemicals that cause cancer, chemicals that cause immune and neurological and developmental problems.
Pollutants from other countries, some of them long banned in the U.S., migrate into the Arctic. Tests for PCBs in residents of St. Lawrence Island found levels up to 10 times higher than other places in the nation. In an area that is often considered a pristine wilderness, Arctic sea mammals also carry high toxin loads in their tissues and organs. Miller says the proposed legislation would identify hotspot communities that are disproportionately impacted by toxins.
And that's really important for Alaska because we know that many Alaska Native communities live in close proximity to military and industrial sites that have a lot of these persistent and toxic chemicals, and would expedite safety determinations and actions to restrict some of the most notorious and harmful of toxic chemicals. These are ones like formaldehyde, lead, and toxic flame retardants.
Miller says another Alaska group impacted by migrating chemical exposure are women in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Test results released in 2009 by the Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Program found that women of childbearing age in the YK Delta had flame-retardant chemicals in their blood at levels 5 to 7 times higher than other places in the nation.
For these levels to be showing up in people who live so far away from where these chemicals are manufactured is evidence for why we need comprehensive chemicals policy reform.
The Safe Chemicals Act would also require chemicals to meet health-based safety standards designed to protect vulnerable populations such as pregnant women and small children. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, young Alaska Natives talk about what it takes to make a great leader.
With unity, we are the strongest. As a community, together, we are invincible. Way better than Superman.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give.
Westward Seafoods was fined nearly $600,000 by the Environmental Protection Agency for allegedly violating the Clean Air Act and the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act at their Unalaska plant. Though the company agreed to negotiate a fine, they did not admit to committing the violations. The alleged violations occurred between 2002 and 2006. The state started investigating the problems, but after asking for information from Westward seven times without receiving any response, the case was turned over to the EPA. Violations included burning 1.3 million gallons of fuel with too much sulfur in it. EPA Air Compliance Inspector John Pavitt says it violated their air quality permit and created unhealthy environmental conditions.
When a facility is burning hundreds of thousands of gallons and millions of gallons of fuel, a small increase in amount of sulfur can produce a lot of sulfur dioxide. And sulfur dioxide is one of the air pollutants we regulate under the Clean Air Act because it affects people's health. If you're breathing air with sulfur dioxide in it and you have respiratory disease, if you have asthma, if you're very young or very old, you're more susceptible to things like that.
Westward also allegedly failed to annually report 80,000 pounds of ammonia stored at the plant to state and local emergency responders. Ammonia is highly explosive and can cause respiratory problems and eye irritations. In addition to the cash fine, the company also has to develop and implement management, reporting, and training plans to make sure the violations do not happen again. Westward Seafoods Vice President Mark Johansson says the company is fully complying with the EPA and have been working with the agency since 2007. They have already taken the necessary steps to get the pollution under control and will begin implementing the required monitoring plans over time. Researchers at the Alaska Volcano Observatory in Anchorage are keeping a close eye on the erupting volcano in Iceland. The ice-covered volcano is similar to many in Alaska, and the widespread disruption is the ash cloud has had to airline traffic is something Alaska's volcano scientists are very familiar with. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
Chris Way-Thomas has seen a lot of volcanic eruptions during his long career at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, but they still managed to capture his imagination. He has just one word to describe the unfolding scene in Europe.
Fascinating.
The volcano's ash cloud has forced the cancellation of about 100,000 flights in Europe. Airports are just starting to open after days of being completely shut down. Way-Thomas says it's been amazing to watch the extent of the disruption to air travel, especially given that the Iceland eruption is not that big as volcanoes go.
The ash clouds have been typically below 35,000 feet, and that's just the threshold for jet aircraft. You know, we had some ash clouds last year from the readout eruption going, you know, to 60,000. So that's kind of surprising, you know, that a relatively modest eruption caused this much havoc.
Way-Thomas calls it a perfect storm of circumstances.
The winds are blowing the right direction. It produced just enough ash to be hazardous, and it drifted right over, you know, northwest Europe, right over the UK and Sweden and Norway and Scotland.
Way-Thomas says in the U.S., the FAA wouldn't be able to completely shut down airspace because of a volcano, like we've seen with the federal agencies in Europe. Instead, decisions on whether or not to fly would be made by the individual airlines.
In the United States, it's really up to the carriers to fly or not fly. I don't think the FAA can close airspace. Whereas in Europe, you know, if Great Britain wants to close down its airspace, they do it. So that's a big difference.
Scientists already know a lot about ash clouds, and forecasting methods have improved in recent years. But Wei Thomas hopes the current disaster spurs more research and more collaboration on volcano science.
The last thing anybody wants to see is an airliner full of people go down because it ran into an ash cloud. That's something no one wants to see happen. So the opportunity is there, and there's a lot of interest. And hopefully this will be a catalyst to spur on more research, better coordination, and the sharing of information from group to group.
Because the Iceland volcano is capped by a glacier, the eruption will also give scientists a chance to study how the two mix. And with so many ice-covered volcanoes in Alaska, scientists here will be paying special attention to that aspect of the eruption. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Some Alaska Native leaders are born, but many are made through struggle and determination. That's the message from Native elders to young Alaska Natives gathered at a UA Anchorage forum last week. As part of our ongoing series on Alaska Native education, KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
They ate pizza, dressed in baggy shorts, casual hoodies and sneakers, and for the most part looked like typical college kids. But a closer look revealed a group of young people bent on changing their world for the better. They were searching for ways to leadership, and key Alaska Native elders were on hand to help them through the maze. But what makes a leader? Some were not sure.
You know, a good leader doesn't really know if he is a leader or isn't. He just sort of steps up to the plate and he speaks from the heart. And I think that is the most effective kind of leadership, because you're dealing with somebody that you know when they get up there and talk, you know that they're talking to you and that they care.
UAA student Cesar Martinson, he spoke at an informal discussion aimed at identifying the basic tenets of leadership. Colleen James said the ability to listen is an essential element.
What challenges do we have with our style of leadership of being able to listen is not everybody knows how to listen. And a lot of people talk from their pain. And that's the part that if we could learn how to listen with our heart, when somebody's talking out of pain, then maybe we can heal together and move forward as a community.
The students were asked to read statements regarding leadership qualities and to pick the one they identified with the most. Vincent Gregory said it was selflessness that attracted him.
You know, part of the reason why I was taking Native studies was so I could have a stronger bond with my dad, because he could fluently speak my Native language. And I always wanted to have that stronger bond with him. And anyway, part of being a leader is, you know, leading by example. And part of why I'm here at UAA is to lead by example for the children back home for me. Because I see kids at like 12 to 18 smoking weed and getting drunk, puffing on smoke. I mean, that's not the future right there. The reason I'm here is, you know, mostly for selflessness, because I want to lead by example. Give these kids a future.
Gregory said youngsters in the villages are not getting a clear message.
Because most of the kids back home, all they have to look forward to is their next video game tournament or their next joint hit or their next shot of booze or something. I mean, that's not a future. If this keeps up like this, our language is going to die and it'll go extinct, and we wouldn't have any more Native future or Native past or anything.
Colleen James agreed that Alaska Native youngsters, especially college students, have unexpected burdens to deal with.
We want our students to go and get an education and then come home and make a difference. But then when they come home, it's not always a warm reception, because there's something that happens when the students are off learning and the people at home are waiting. The alcohol, and there's all that negativity. The benefits, you're going to bring that strength back to your community, and you're going to empower a lot of young people. That's the benefit to listening.
Vincent Gregory told how Native Studies helped him through a tough time.
When my dad died last semester, these Native classes actually saved my spirit, because I wanted to, like, give up, man. I was like, man, I don't want to go to college no more. I want to give up. And these Native, the Native spirit and strength from that I get from this college actually saved my future, saved my past, and kept me going and kept me strong. And now I've got this undying resolve, like nothing shall sway me from my path. I mean, there's nothing on earth that could keep me distracted from my future. I mean, a few video games here and there, but nonetheless, though, culture, tradition, and native dancing. I mean, native dancing alone, you know, really kept me going, because sometimes I would go to class dragging my feet and I would walk it out, yeah, on to native dancing. With unity, we are the strongest. As a community, together, we are invincible, way better than Superman.
Elder Howard Luck told the students to throw away the script and always speak from the heart. Then people will hear. The Alaska Native Leadership Forum was last in a series focusing on challenges facing Alaska Native youth. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
Chemical contamination of groundwater in North Pole is having an effect on the local real estate market. North Pole realtor Dave Frimmer says people looking for homes are being cautious.
We have buyers that are a little bit nervous. They want to make sure that the property they're looking at are not in the way of that plume. The seller tests the property, and the water's okay before they do the purchase.
Frimmer says many potential sellers are holding off putting their properties on the market, either to make sure they're clear of well contamination or to install alternative water systems. He says sellers have to disclose well contamination.
If you're a seller within that plume area, you know, when you do your state disclosures, then you need to disclose that it's detectable on your property. And I think that will affect your sales.
Borough Assessor Pat Carlson says he's watching for market response, but so far there hasn't been a significant downturn.
This is much like what we went through with arsenic or radon. You know, we are vigilant and looking for indications of impacts. To the extent that we've had transactions to date, we've not observed any impacts at this point.
Carlson says real estate impacts are being eased by refinery owner Flint Hills' conscientious response to the sulfalane contamination. Flint Hills spokesman Jeff Cook says the company's intent is to provide sulfalane-free water.
We're looking at various options, which we hope to pin down here in the next 1 to 3 months. And, you know, those in the city, the option of city water is obviously an easier one than for those outside the city. But bulk water storage tanks, And looking at private treatment systems, individual well treatment systems are among the things we're looking at.
In the meantime, Flint Hills has been providing bottled drinking water. Cook says well testing continues and a final assessment of the extent of the contamination should be available in about a month. Lawmakers created a new state forest in southern southeast Alaska shortly before they adjourned for the year. They passed a bill that combined about 20 state parcels, totaling about 25,000 acres. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Most of the land that will make up the southeast state forest is on central and northern Prince of Wales Island. It includes parcels in the vicinity of Thorn Bay, Whale Pass, Edna Bay, and Kaufman Cove. Other lands are near Ketchikan and Wrangell. State Forester Chris Mache says the goal is to improve timberland so they can support the region's struggling mills.
Some of the land has been harvested in the past, and so we will actively manage those lands to do pre-commercial thinning to speed the growth of the young timber that's growing back on those sites. But we still have stands of timber that we'll continue to harvest.
The state's ongoing timber sale program provides between 8.5 and 9 million board feet a year. The state forest will not increase sales in the short term since the parcels are already slated for timber development, but Mache says it will guarantee the land is not sold or selected by a borough.
When we do build access into timber sales, we'll build higher order roads, and often we might use a bridge that we'll leave in place as opposed to a log stringer bridge. And so we'll basically be making investments for the long term, since we know we'll own and manage this land now for the long term.
Timber and other resource development groups supported the legislation. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council raised concerns about parcels on Gravina Island near Ketchikan. SEAC did not immediately respond to a call for comment. There were also objections to a parcel near Wrangell because it's a popular recreation area. State Forester Mesh says the land will continue to be available for hunting and other public use. He says road building for logging will increase access to some areas. Contracts for improving stands in some of the parcels are already out to bid.
We'll be thinning about 1,000 acres over the next 12 to, say, 24 months. And the number of jobs that create, it's hard to estimate, but, you know, that's a pretty significant acreage. So there will be a number of jobs created, maybe upwards of 15 or 20.
Southeast mills have been struggling to find timber to keep running. Klawock's Viking Lumber continues to operate, but Ketchikan's Pacific Log and Lumber closed 18 months ago, and Wrangell's Silver Bay Mill is being taken apart. Wrangell Representative Peggy Wilson says the new state forest could help the region's industry, but it's too late for her town.
It's just a sad situation that they're dismantling the mill by Wrangell because there might have been able to employ and get started and do some things, but they've already dismantled a lot of it and sold it for the weight of the metal.
The Southeast Forest will be the third in the state system. One is near Haines and the other is in the Tanana Valley near Fairbanks. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
About 40 people, a few carrying guns, held a peaceful rally in downtown Fairbanks yesterday. The Patriots Day event was one of several held across the country by local branches of the Second Amendment Task Force. Fairbanks organizer Coleman Barney says the display of guns is only symbolic of Americans' responsibility to keep government in check.
Some people think that this is a statement of we need to aggress the government, and that's not the case. We believe in government. We believe in law and order. And that's why I think at this point it's important that we start talking about it and about what we can do and the things that we can do as a community so that it never even gets close to that point.
Others at the event, like Neil Wetherington, express concern about government control that stretches far beyond the scope of the Constitution.
I see that my children and my grandchildren are likely not going to have the freedoms and the country that I've grown up and nearly taken for granted.
Wetherington cited health care mandates recently passed by Congress as an example of unconstitutional government overreach. The Second Amendment Task Force rally marked Patriots Day, which commemorates the battles of Lexington and Concord, which began the Revolutionary War. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you file for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give.
The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.